We are in the last of the six sessions on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. We thought the best way to conclude this series was to take a page from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, more like the Commission's final page, and 94 calls to action. All 94 are worth reading. But the Commission very smartly grouped them together into common themes. So, Kathleen and Phil, let's start with calls to action 1 to 5. They all have to do with the welfare of the child. Why is that so important in the top 5 as a starting point?
Well, the whole issue of the residential school experience has to do with children, the welfare of children, and the good of children, generations of children. The TRC would have never come into existence. We would have never heard the 94 calls to action. We would have never been advised that we had a hill to climb. This government and church-inspired experiment led us down the path where we are now talking about what do we do to bring about reconciliation given the horrific experiences of many.
My name is Cindy Blackstock. I'm Gitxsan, which is a nation in British Columbia. I am the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society Canada and a professor at McGill University. You know, I think of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's calls to action as the survivors' work plan for the country. And those survivors told their truths through their tears so that this generation of children and ones to follow would not have to endure unnecessary family separations, poor educational opportunities, or poor health care. And that's why the first 5 to 6 calls to action all directly focus on children. People hear the word overrepresentation. I don't really like that word because it's too easy to say. What we know from the data about the overrepresentation, in quotes, of First Nations children is that they're 17.2 times more likely to be in foster care than other children. The reasons for that link right back to colonialism, poverty, poor housing, caregiver mental health issues that result in addictions and sometimes in domestic violence. Those are the issues that put our kids at risk. The way I like to think about it, though, is the way children themselves think about it, which is how many nights do I see my mom? And in evidence before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal on a long case that is still going on to remedy inequalities in First Nations children's services, the number of sleeps that First Nations children spent away from their families and in foster care between about 1989 and 2011 was over 66 million nights. That's a lot of childhood. And it can be prevented by the Government of Canada providing the equitable and culturally based supports that these families need to overcome the trauma of residential schools and to be able to thrive. Because the survivors wanted to make sure that the harms that were done to them, specifically being separated from their families and not getting the education that they deserved and the health care they deserved, that that should never happen again, including to their grandchildren. So they prioritized the treatment of this generation of children and the ones to follow in what they require the country to do.
I know as a viewer, as an observer, it was riveting, it was horrifying, it was painful to watch, to listen to these stories day after day as the commission moved forward toward that report. What was it like being so close to it, the creation of it, and seeing it unfold?
Kathleen and I started off this process of negotiating the settlement agreement as partners.
The largest settlement, we should say, in Canadian history.
And one of the largest in the world.
First of all, let me say that it was the biggest honor of my life to be involved in this. I came from a human rights background as a professor of law, and also was very much involved in the women's movement and did a lot of things around the world. But being involved in this Canadian case and being able to have some say, which was an incredible honor, it changed my life. It changed my appreciation of who I am and where I fit in. And so, yeah, being on the inside, I was able to bring what I knew as a lawyer and as a professional human rights advocate and activist. I was able to bring that to this concept and have somebody like Phil and Fred Kelly and other elders help shape that knowledge into a approach which would address, you know, these horrific problems in Canadian law, in Canadian history, and to come out at the other end with something that might change things. We had no guarantees, of course. But what's interesting about the TRC and what people need to understand about it is all of the calls to action are about systems, right? There's a child welfare system. There's the judicial system. There's the prison system. There's the private
healthcare
sector. There's the healthcare system. They're all systems. And the reason they're in the 94 calls to action is because all of those systems have worked against Indigenous peoples. And the 94 calls to action address how we can change those systems. We can change them through educating ourselves about our own history, about Indigenous cultures and values. We can learn about why those things happened the way they did and what is the path we can go forward with that would avoid the mistakes of the past. So that's what's so transformative about the TRC calls to action. Because if they were all implemented, and it's not just the federal government's job to implement them, there's recommendations or calls to action in there that apply to provinces, municipalities, the private sector, banks.
This is on some level part of that as well, this desire to help people better understand something we never learned in school.
Well, you know, the Chief Commissioner, Marie Sinclair, famously said, all this problem started with education. The way to cure it is through education, you see. So education is absolutely vital. And when we can see the 94 calls to action address education, they talk about children from K to 12 and then university from undergraduate right through to graduate studies being made aware of where they are in the Canadian world, you know, of history and law and education, and look at any discipline, medicine, all of those disciplines have had their systemic problems with respect to Indigenous peoples. So education throughout the entire system of education that we have has to address these things.
Preserving language and culture was part of that call to action on education. And the TRC really highlights the risk of erosion on both fronts. Explain that.
Language encompasses or holds everything that we are as a peoples. Our customs, our traditions, our histories, those are all part of the language that we speak, the various tribes speak, I should say. And because of very deliberate programs and policies and actions on the part of successive governments, including through vehicle of residential schools, our languages, every language, including the ones that remain strong today, Ojibwe, Cree, and Inuktitut, are in the process of extinction. And when you lose your language, you lose everything that the language represents. And so the residential school experience, the residential school experiment, I would call it at this point, was very successful in terms of language disruption. the disappearance of indigenous languages, because as I said, most are in various stages of extinction. They're disappearing, fast disappearing. And how do we go back and retrieve and reclaim our languages? How do we relearn the languages, our languages, that are so important, not just to us, but the country? If we lose one language, it's a loss not just to the people that whose language has been lost, but it's a loss to the country. Now, let's see if French was somehow on the verge of disappearing from Canada or from Quebec. It has a homeland. The language home has a homeland. It's France, right? English, same thing.
Well, the province also has laws to protect the language.
And that isn't so in our case. We have a language institute, but there's no law in the books that protect indigenous languages.
So we've talked about self-governance, self-determination. Should that independence also apply to education?
Of course. It's essential. It's essential, especially and most importantly, that it be based on language and culture from the various cultural interests, indigenous cultural interests.
Well, there has to be a willingness on the part of government as well to support it. Because if you look at the data, for example, against the preservation of French and English, the budget for that is $380 million per year. The budget for the preservation of indigenous languages is about $9 million. If you look at up north, in Nunavut, there's a very small minority of French people that live there, but there's a per capita funding of $4,000 per person if you're French Canadian, but if you're Inuit, there's $44. So let's talk about preservation of languages in a serious way. You know, if Canada is serious about its culture and its First Peoples, and, you know, the problem is that they're not serious about it, because if they were serious, just like the Indian residential schools, if they were serious about educating the kids, they would have funded it properly.
How many languages are we talking about?
Well, as Bill said, there's basically
70 plus. I'm probably understating this, but at a minimum, there are between 70 and 100 distinct indigenous languages in the country.
But over 67% are dying.
Yeah. How many?
67%.
Just about all of them, in fact. Mm-hmm. Every one of them. Ojibwe is disappearing. Cree is disappearing. Inuktitut is disappearing, even though these are the strongest indigenous languages that exist in Canada.
I want to continue our exploration of the calls to action, where you feel we're at now at this stage. And I mean, if you had to put a priority on it, so many of them, more than a dozen, have to do with the justice system. Does that volume also indicate the critical nature of forcing change on that front? And I know we talked about the justice system in an earlier session, but I'd love your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't think they're numbered strategically necessarily in terms of importance, because every single one of those 94 calls to action are critical, important, and absolutely essential in terms of addressing those 94 calls to action. When the report was made public, it was very clearly spelled out that this was about reconciliation. The TRC report and the 94 calls to action was to lead to reconciliation. And we were reminded that reconciliation was a journey. It would be like climbing a steep hill, and it would be very, very difficult. There would be no easy steps in bringing about reconciliation. And it was true then, it's even more true now, right, that It's not going to be easy. It's going to be a very difficult journey that we're all on. And some will want to bail from the journey. They'll want to take the easy way out and say, well, that's not my responsibility. I didn't cause those harms. Why should I be forced to think about reconciliation? It had nothing to do with it. And that may be true, but it's a weak excuse.
Well, one of the things that I think we need to remember is what colonization is when we talk about assimilation. And there we can look at what I call the savage and civilized dichotomy. This has been said by others, like Robert Williams from the United States. And really what it is an idea that everything that indigenous peoples are is savage, and everything that the Western civilization does is civilized. And that has been threaded through government laws, government policies, and indeed even into the Canadian psyche. By not educating Canadians about First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples, or newcomers to the country about First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples, and propagating different stereotypes. The key thing that I want people to remember is that the harms done to First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples in the past, and the ones happening right now, they could have been prevented. In a large majority of cases, there were solutions on the books. The public knew about those solutions, and the government chose not to implement them. They didn't fail. That's a different thing. They chose not to implement them. And that choosing has been made possible when the public isn't paying attention. The good news is, for example, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's calls to action, we saw the government implement more of the calls to action in the 6 weeks following the discovery of children in unmarked graves than in the previous 6 years. So when the public holds its attention to these solutions, like murdered, missing Indigenous women and girls, National Inquiry, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, before that something called the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, and they keep on asking their politicians about it, then change actually happens that's durable and that's in the best interests of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples, and Canada too.
How do you gauge success or progress with reconciliation?
It's one example is going to school, an elementary school in Calgary, and learning that that school teaches kids about residential schools, about Indigenous peoples, about treaties, in a very rudimentary way, right? Not, or superficial way, and not at incredible depth. But the kids that attend that school and attend those classes are asking questions about residential schools. And I think that's progress. Kids that have an opportunity to go to a sweat or are exposed to teepees and what they mean, and they're given an opportunity to assist and support the gentleman that designed the teepee.
So
to erect it. And, you know, that's
educate in a way rather than it be sort of a spectacle, be a culture, be a lesson learned. And I think you're right. That is definitely a sign of progress.
And the other one, too, I think is really important. We have immersion schools now in places like Winnipeg, Ojibwe immersion schools, Cree immersion schools. There are language classes at the University of Manitoba in Ojibwe and Cree. And so there is progress, but it has to be a concerted effort, absolutely. And
Well, universities are making a difference too. I mean, that's my world. And we can see changes in curriculum, for example. We can see changes in hiring practices, changes in qualifications for entry into a program, changes in scholarships. So again, the systems of running universities have systemically discriminated against Indigenous people. So those systems are being addressed, and that's progress. That's huge progress. In my specific profession of the law, I mean, the law is the most powerful system we have. That's what controls people's behavior, right? And when the law itself is a system that discriminates against a race of people in your country, and furthermore, the first peoples of the country, there's something absolutely organically and fundamentally wrong. So what we're seeing is things like the University of Victoria, which is now producing students with a degree in Indigenous law, along with their common law degree. So we're actually seeing practitioners now of Indigenous law. We see a tremendous faculty at that particular university, but it's not the only one. UBC has a great program. York has a good program. Most law schools, including my own, teach Indigenous law now. So that's progress because, you know, we've talked about judicial decisions, we've talked about statutes, we've talked about police. All of those people are in the justice system, and they make it possible for discrimination to happen. They can also make it possible for human rights to happen when things change. So, you know, one really interesting example was the settlement agreement, where we were talking law, yes, about personal injury and about all this abuse to individual kids, but when it came to the TRC, when it came to healing funds, when it came to commemoration, when it came to language and culture, the lawyers were not there. There were 80 lawyers around the table talking about personal injury, which is what we teach in law school, and that's what gets you money. We don't teach truth commissions. We don't teach about healing. We don't teach, or haven't in the past, taught anybody about Indigenous values. So when we negotiated the Truth Commission, we were the only people there.
That
the
actually speaks AFN volumes team. Right there, yes. And the lack of understanding.
That's right.
That's not my world.
That's not my world. So even though it was abundantly clear to us that this was the most important piece, that the clients, this is what they really wanted as their number one priority, all of those other lawyers were out of the room. Nobody kept them out. But they didn't attend because my guess is they didn't feel comfortable. They didn't understand that type of remedy. It's not taught in law schools. So, you know, that speaks to our curriculum. It speaks to the importance we put on, you know, our multi-juridical system. As I was saying earlier, we do have three systems of law in this country, but this one over here, Indigenous law, has been ignored. And now it is being reawakened. And you asked us earlier too, what is Indigenous law? Well, in many communities, it disappeared because it wasn't used and nobody respected it. Now it's being revitalized, and a lot of these PhD students are going out, listening to the stories of the elders and figuring out what principles are embedded in these stories that they can then write down and codify as principles of Indigenous law. And there's now books that set out Cree principles of law, for example. It's available in the bookstore.
You know, justice was part of it, healthcare as well, also one of the calls to action. And it's fascinating, the Canadian healthcare system. And I just wonder if it's at odds with Indigenous medical practices.
No. Obviously, when you or I get sick, we want to heal, right? But healing isn't necessarily a concept that works its way into medical practice, that you just get treated. And if you come out at the end of the day better than when you went in, you have healed. But there isn't that notion of the other parts of your life that might need healing that have perhaps led to your injury or your disease. So there's no reason why these two systems of medical understanding couldn't work. I mean, we've done it with Chinese medicine. It used to be Chinese medicine's doctors, medical doctors, were thought to be, you know, some esoteric weird thing. I happen to have a cousin who is a Chinese medical doctor. And she can treat people that are ill, and they can go to the hospital and ask for a Chinese practitioner to come and work with the mainstream practitioners to help a person's holistic reality, to help them heal in a good way. So, you know, there's no reason why Indigenous healers can't be included. They're not antithetical to medical practice. You know, and in fact, here in Vancouver at St. Paul's Hospital, there's Indigenous people, elders will come in and talk to patients and engage with them. That never happened before. That's new.
Isn't that a result, though, of surveys they did at that hospital and other hospitals where they could clearly identify if an Indigenous person came into the emergency room, they were treated differently than a non-Indigenous person? And it was horrifying even to staff. So where does racism, just racism, fit in here as a way of the biggest question on how to reverse that and for equal treatment?
Well, you have to deal with it, and we have tools to deal with that. I mean, when racism happens, as it did in this horrible case in Winnipeg, where a man died waiting for treatment in emergency after 2 days of sitting in his wheelchair, we do have mechanisms to deal with that through human rights legislation, through criminal code legislation, but we should also turn to the Indigenous community and say, how can we prevent this? Where is there systems engaged where an Indigenous person can get be absolutely assured of getting the help that they need? And that speaks to establishing Indigenous health authorities. And there's BC has an Indigenous health authority. Manitoba's working in that direction. So, you know, there's ways in which to deal with that, but we're in the infant stages of those developments. But this is part of all of this is part of reconciliation, because what reconciliation means is you're looking at what was taken away from the in this case, the race of people. What did the dominant society do to injure and harm those people? And what can we do to reconcile those harms? And that's what the TRC is dealing with its systemic approach, because it's the systems that were put in place that has done all the harm.
Phil, do you want to weigh in as well on that same question of if the core of this is racism?
What do we do with the racists? Racism is the result of ignorance, not knowing. And so the most effective way to deal with racism is through education and information. If we're talking about the general scheme of things, it's through public education and public information, and you can't impose yourself on racists. Right? They'll push back, and they usually do. But if you're deliberate in your actions in reaching out to people, I think that is far better than being very direct and imposing on others. Racism, my God, it's not an easy subject. It takes real time to understand racism and what it means and why someone is racist and another isn't.
It's also at the core, though, of this entire history, this entire Indigenous history, and the last six episodes where we've talked about what is the core of it. It's eradicating a culture. So part of it, as far as progress goes, was getting an apology from the Pope, certainly. But I just wonder, beyond the church, are there any more asks for the government at this point?
Well, the single biggest challenge that we face as a country is mass poverty in First Nation communities. So the challenge is the eradication of mass poverty in First Nation communities. If we can manage that, we can take on any issue that has challenged successive governments in every part of the country. Indians are poor everywhere. First Nations people, Indigenous peoples, are poor in every part of the country, the poorest of the poor. And there's no single reason, there's no one reason why they are, other than the underlying issue is racism. I mean, I've sat down in airports next to very prominent business people. And they engage me, let's see, they're trying to engage me in a discussion, a conversation about Indigenous peoples. And one of the accusations that was leveled, not against me necessarily, but it included me, is that why can't you trust your people? Why is it that they don't deliver? Why is it that they steal? Why is it that they end up in jail? There's no answer for that. Right? The guy, that person, wanted to be, to represent himself as a thoughtful person that considered all of the issues in a very thoughtful way. But he was a racist jerk. And he didn't know it, right? He thought he had the answers. But he didn't. What are you going to do? I just say to myself, I'm not going to waste my time with this person. It's not worth it. But then if you think about it, he may be one of hundreds, if not thousands, of people that think the same way he does. And so what do we do?
Well, I guess the question then is, what is the obligation of engaged non-Indigenous people to do our part as well? And Kathleen, having been so close to this, what would you say as far as advice goes to people who are engaged, who are watching this, who do care and who do want a positive future, who don't want to see the poverty levels and the stats that we've been talking about?
Well, I could tell you a little story that came out of a conference that I organized on truth commissions. And I invited a person from South Africa to come to the conference, and his name was Bogadi Finta. He was a commissioner on the South African Truth Commission. And he told this story. And the story was about a man called Tabo who had a cow. And there was a man called Mr. White who came and took Tabo's cow. But he didn't pay for it. He just took it. It had a devastating effect on Tabo because he could no longer feed his children. He could no longer earn an income so that they could get educated. He could no longer maintain a safe home for his kids. So along came the Truth Commission. And Mr. White came to visit Mr. Tabo, invited him in. They chatted, they had a cup of tea, they told a few jokes. They hugged, they said, he walked him to the gate, and before he left, Tabo said to Mr. White, "Well, what about the cow?" And Mr. White scolded Mr. Tabo in an angry voice and said, "Mr. Tabo, this is not about the cow. This is about reconciliation." So I like that story because in a very simple way, it talks about what we have to do to contemplate reconciliation. What about the cow? See? And that brings us back to the treaties. It brings us back to the land issue, it brings us back to self-determination, it brings us back to residential schools, all of those things. It brings us back to sharing the resources of Canada, which made us one of the most wealthy countries and privileged countries in the world that has this tremendous poverty that can be identified and the people we took that wealth away from. So asking what about the cow, I think, can guide us non-Indigenous people as to what reconciliation must have to mean, regardless of who you are. If you're in the media, if you're in the legal profession, wherever you happen to be, you can ask yourself that question, because all of us have benefited from the cow.
That's a great story, and it really is powerful in telling it. And I wonder, Phil, for you, I mean, the word reconciliation, when I think of the amazing story of your mother having been the first woman on an elected band council.
Mm-hmm. June 1952.
I'm pretty sure the term reconciliation wasn't on anybody's lips.
No. She was elected and first woman.
But what do we take from her life, her forcing change, and where we are today as we sort of wrap up this whole concept
that was a good example to me, you know, that anything is possible. If I reflect back on that moment, I attended one council meeting with her, and at the band hall on the stage where the council members would meet, and she was there. I sat beside her and I listened to the council speak, the chief, it was a pretty interesting moment. It was inspirational. I didn't think about it in those terms, right? Oh, gosh, my mom is inspirational. She's such a tough woman. Where she demonstrated her toughness and her commitment and how to deal with people that appear to have power over you was when the hydro man came to our place on the reserve to turn off the power to our house because my mom hadn't paid the hydro bill. And so the hydro man climbed the hydro pole. You know, they have those, they're pretty fancily dressed.
Those fancy boots.
Yeah. And switched off, and that's how they did it in those days, switch off the power from top of the hydro pole, then saw my mom down there at the bottom with her broom. And he had been coming down, but he had looked down, and he thought, oh, he climbed back up.
That's restorative justice.
Switched back that, and came down, and he said to my mother, "See you, Mrs. Fontaine."
I bring her up at the very last of our discussions because I think that is an example of how change can happen. One person can force change. And now, what would your advice be for the Indigenous community as well as we try to move forward and force change?
Pay your hydro bill. Pay your bills. And it just so happens that at that time, my mom couldn't, but she was desperate, right? She was going to be desperate, and she took matters into her own hands, and that was it. And I wonder what the hydro man said to his boss when he got back to the station in the town next to the reserve there. It must have been pretty funny to him as it was to us. We laughed about that at home, right? And so sometimes desperate times, cliche, right, require desperate measures. And you do what you have to do. You take matters into your own hands. And you hope that with good sense, you'll make the right decision, that you'll make the right decisions. And I took that approach when I was elected as a young leader in my community. I was just a young guy. I didn't really know how to run or manage the affairs of a community. I had to learn as I went along. And I came into the position angry, That's not why I was elected. I was just a young guy. They didn't elect me because they knew I was an angry guy, but I was angry with government, with generally with white people. And most of my actions in the early days of my tenure, in my four-year tenure as chief, was motivated by anger, retribution, and use a lot of rough language. And I just thought that was the way to do it. That's the way things were done. That's the way you made progress. But I learned that it wasn't. I learned that it was far healthier to be respectful to people and to treat others the way you wanted to be treated. And my first target was always the government people, right? Because that was the interaction that most engaged me. And so, like the union agent that left the band office and told me that he wasn't welcome there, he didn't feel welcome. And he said he was going to leave. And I said, good, fine, leave then. And you know, I could have handled it a different way maybe, and treated them with more respect than I had. And because he was a decent guy, he was just young and I remember being at a meeting with him. I mean, he didn't know any more than I did. But we never really crossed paths professionally after he left the community. I'd see him maybe in the office in Winnipeg. Just hello, and that would be it. But it wasn't long after that kind of experience when I left the position of chief and I became a civil servant as well. I joined the public service. Went to the Yukon, and I had to deal with tough issues. And people, my brothers and sisters, in a sense, taking runs at me, tough ones, at public meetings. And I had to sit there and take it, right? Because in most of the time, they were right. And they also thought that the best way to deal with people like Phil here, this Indian agent guy, is to be rough and tough on them. And
that's a full circle story, yes, right there.
It wasn't easy. My last meeting in the Yukon was the toughest meeting I had up there. And I was, you know, in a room full of community members, and the chief was a rough-talking guy, tough guy. And he showed all of his toughness and how rough he was towards me that evening. And it didn't matter what I said to him. Didn't matter what I said to try and reassure him. He was taking none of it. And that is fine, right? One of the people that worked for me was an First Nation guy from Ontario. He said, don't worry about him. That's just his style. It's just a stylistic kind of thing. And years later, I was national chief. I came across this guy, right? Different setting, different circumstances. And he was as nice as could be to me. Right, respectful, and I'm sure he remembered as well as I did our last meeting, the last confrontation he had with me, and it was all in the past. We were moving forward, and
or were you more powerful than he was, and he was afraid of you?
Well, I occupied a different role, and I not necessarily more influence, but I tried to exercise as much influence as the position could bring to the table when I was dealing with government. And I wasn't the savviest guy in the room or the smartest guy, never. I never came into Rome thinking that I was going to demonstrate to the people there that I was the smartest guy, right? I wasn't. I never was. And so I had to learn. I had to learn quite often on the spot. And in the main, it worked out quite nicely for me. If you're thinking of it, if you're thinking of this in terms of my career and what I've been able to do with what little I had in the head, it's not bad, you know, not bad. Come from a reserve. I was a res guy, poor, single mom, and to try and figure my way out of this situation. It wasn't easy. I became, like many of my relatives and friends, I got hooked on alcohol, right? Became an alcoholic. I drank, and eventually quit. And it became too much of a burden on my family, mostly my family. And okay.
But the importance of what you're telling right now, the truth of it, this whole project is called Understanding Indigenous History. And you have just in one sentence explained so many of the issues. And now the question is, what's the one thing we can all do to find that path forward?
I think we have to be open-minded. We have to be, you know, be accepting of others that are different, that behave differently than you're used to, that speak a different language, that may be from a different culture, and accept those differences with respect, with truthfulness. And if you do it that way, I think it's far better than being truly aggressive. I remember when I first went to Toronto, when I was a young guy with the Company of Young Canadians, I was sent on a mission there to go meet with one of the volunteers of the Company of Young Canadians. Most of the street was filled with white people walking here and there and busy going this way and that way. I go back now, and this has been so for a number of years, the colors are so different. So different. So many different cultures, so many different languages, and the attitudes are different as well because of the cultural differences. And that's true in most every big city in the country. And Nelson, I mean, for the longest time, when we would spend our summers in Nelson, we only saw white, mostly white people, very few people of color. Now, it's an incredibly diverse community that has emerged in Nelson. We were in Iceland months ago, and Iceland is predominantly white from the Viking heritage. They have Viking heritage there, very strong. We only saw two African-American people there, two women. One was a renowned human rights lawyer in Iceland. The other had a very popular TikTok show. Two in this country that was, the women all looked the same. Kathleen made this remark. to us in our little group that the women are so incredibly beautiful. They all look the same. The men, not so much.
That's normal. That's in normal society.
but that is one of the most striking features of, wow, of Iceland. And that's the way they've lived for years and years and years. Now it's changing with two people.
It's amazing.
Maybe when we go back somewhere the next time, maybe 5 or 10. Nelson is really different now from your time as a young woman there.
I feel like honored, first of all, to have had this opportunity to sit with both of you, to learn from both of you. You're such a dynamic, fascinating couple with so much history on the Indigenous and non-Indigenous side. And I want to just thank you for letting me be part of this really exciting project.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I hope it's been an honor to work with you.
You were our first choice.
We'll cut that part, Phil.
Yeah, you were. No, really, you were. When we were looking around to see who we might call on to be moderator to this important discussion that Kathleen and I believe had to take place, we turned to you.
I am so honored. It is definitely a complicated journey. It's been it's a complicated history, and I am just so honored and grateful to both of you for bringing me into this fascinating project, an important project. I've loved learning and listening to both of you.
University Canada West and University of Niagara Falls Canada are immensely proud to work with Phil Fontaine, Dr. Kathleen Mahoney, Lisa Laflamme, and everyone that poured their hearts and time into this project. We believe in the power of knowledge and the importance of the truth. This endeavor is vital, not just for our universities, but for our nation. It's a step towards acknowledging past wrongs and fostering respect and paving a way for a better future, a more inclusive future. Let's continue to learn and grow together. Thank you for being part of this transformative journey.